Welcome back to another episode of Seven Deadly Sinners. In this episode, we will wrap up my very fascinating, heartbreaking, and important call with Alicia Owen, victim of the Franklin scandal. One that many don't believe is true. One that the ones that looked into it know it to be true. And one that the ones that lived it, well, it's a part of them that will never go away. And many of them didn't live to tell their stories. But before we get into it, I wanted to say thank you guys so much for listening and remind you again to share your stories. Like I said in the last few episodes, I am itching to do a listener stories episode soon because some of my favorite episodes on other podcasts to listen to are listener stories. I just find them so fascinating. You know, send me anything, like your grandma's alien encounter, your great aunt finding cash inside her walls, the drug dealer preacher from your hometown, ghosts in hotels you've stayed in, family secrets, unexplained encounters in the woods, or, you know, on a long drive, you saw something weird, maybe a Bigfoot. Yeah, let's just put it out there. As always, please, someone have a Bigfoot story. He's my best friend and the thing I listen to fall asleep at night. And on that note, I should actually shout out to Sasquatch Chronicles and What If It's True, two of my favorite podcasts with the most charming hosts. So, you got a cryptid story, Bigfoot, ghost. Was your family in the mafia? Are you in the mafia now? No, you don't want to tell me about that on there. But if you have something, think about it. I want to hear your stories. So write them in. Email them to 7deadlysinnerspodcast@gmail.com. Alicia and I made a pact to not have her have to relive the trauma of what happened to her. So while going through the next 3.5 hours of her conversation, I was trying to figure out how to craft this episode. And a few points stood out. Her bravery, her parents' love, and Gary Caradori and his son. If you've listened to the episode back in 2021, that included Gary's story. So you'll have some backstory, but hearing Alicia speak about him and him being a framework for this episode really gives credence to the danger these kids were in, but also any adult that wanted to help them. There was a huge risk involved in uncovering these crimes. And I want to thank Alicia for being so open, so kind, and just thank you for being a new friend. You're just one of the most special people. But Gary and his son were not the only carnage or alleged carnage in this atomic bomb disaster of destroying human lives.
The plane blew up in midair. Shortly thereafter, the FBI shows up and, his briefcase is gone. There are things that are missing from the wreckage. After they killed Gary, it was like, you don't get to kill my friends because they're doing the right thing and then expect me to fold on them. They killed him and his 8-year-old son, AJ. You wanted to come forward, you got attacked. I don't know what it is with them, but they like to document what they've done and in film or pictures. Gary had hunted down or tracked one of the photographer guys and we all talked about him in our tapes. He found him. Yeah, no, it's real. It's definitely real. And it was pretty easy to do. And the amount of money was insane.
Crazy.
And the thing that is, the thing with Troy, and like I said, because you asked about what, any time that I had to do it, it was usually we met at like and it was only like a couple of times. We met at this kind of seedy motel place, and it was just because there really wasn't that much time to go, you know, if you wanted to make it back that evening. And like I said, when Troy would actually probably, and I believe that's like the source, because I never went to the source. When Troy would actually have to go meet with somebody and go to where it is, wherever, you know, because when I was there, the coke was brought to me at wherever I was. And then, you know, we geared it up and turned around and left not much longer after that. We like would go eat something and then, you know, pack it up on ourselves, and then we would head to the airport. But when Troy would leave early in the morning and then come back late at night, he had talked about he would have to drive almost, it was more than two, less than three, I think, drive a couple hours to go get it. And then he would have to drive a couple hours to get back. And he said that, you know, one of his biggest fears was getting caught speeding and then getting busted that way. So he had to, it was really tight connection. That's where I always got the, you know, you don't want to wind up in a garbage bag in the desert. And
because you guys went there a few times, or
he did. That's where that's what he always talked about being. He always told me that was like really scary. That was, he hated to have to do that, but he always went alone. And he said that those people were scary. You know, like I said, he never exactly told me, but he told me it was, and, you know, Troy didn't really, when it came to the whole drug culture thing, he never really was scared. I mean, he was, when it came to the drug culture thing, that was kind of like his niche. He was, you know, he knew how to move drugs. When they called him, like, you know, Mr. Hollywood, he was a good looking guy. And
yeah, I've seen,
you know,
he's a handsome kid.
Well, even in those videos, by that time drugs had really taken their toll. But, you know, when he was 16, 17, 18, he was, I mean, he could have been a model. He was really a good looking guy and dressed very well. I mean, he was like the quintessential stereotype, you know, good looking guy at a club that always had whatever kind of drugs you ever wanted and was, and he wasn't a jerk about it.
Alicia's experience with running drugs was go in the morning, come back at night, in and out. She wouldn't have to go to the person, they would come to her. She'd meet them at a seedy sort of motel near the ocean. I kind of have to guess Venice, maybe Santa Monica, likely off Lincoln Boulevard, but I'm just spitballing here based on living in LA. Anyway, so Troy's experience was different though than hers. On some of his trips to LA, he would have to drive 2 hours into the desert and meet with very scary people. Alicia was never on these runs, but Troy told her enough. Enough that she recalls the normally calm, cool, collected drug runner Troy was in this scenario very scared. Scared of the people he met. Scared of being pulled over for speeding and then the drugs found. Scared that he'd miss his flight back because, remember, this was an in-and-out day trip, and he needed to report back to the adult men he was running drugs for.
It's the summer of 1988, and I'm in jail. I get sentenced to 3 to 4 years in prison for bad check writing, and I want to make sure that people understand that I do take responsibility. That I did write those checks.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote those checks thinking that I would have the money, you know, sincerely believing that I would have the money. But the fact is, I did write the check when I knew that the money wasn't in the bank account at the exact moment I wrote the check. And mm-hmm. that I take responsibility for, and that is a wrong thing to do. So I don't want people to think that I try and wiggle my way out or blame everything on Franklin or anything. That was wrong, and I should not have done that.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that's interesting about that that sentence is, that sentence was done concurrent, which when you get sentenced on multiple charges, a judge can run those sentences consecutive or concurrent. And I'm sorry. Okay. So concurrent means they all run together. So if you have two, like, I'm just giving you an example. If you have two charges and let's say you get a 1 to 2 year sentence and they run them, these two charges that you've got 1 to 2 years, if they run them concurrent, they run at the same time. So your sentence is really 1 to 2 years. But if you have two charges and you get 1 to 2 years on each one and they run them consecutive, that means you have to do the full 2 years on the first charge. Then you can start doing the time on the second charge. So even though you have these sentences, if they're run consecutive, you're going to do more time because you have to complete one charge. You don't get parole. You don't get all this extra stuff. You have to complete, and then you start a new charge. So mm-hmm. My sentence was I was going to do 4 years.
So we are now back to the timeline. It's 1988. Alicia is in jail after being sent back to Nebraska, and her trial ends in her being sentenced to 3 to 4 years in prison for writing bad checks.
So I was completely resigned to doing, 4 years in prison. And at this time, the fall of Franklin was all over the news, and it made sense to me. I understood, okay, I ran off. I knew I was kind of a loose cannon, and this was, in my opinion, a way to ensure that I was tucked away and not available for any investigations or for me to talk about what was going on in Omaha at the time. And I kind of looked at it as almost a punishment for running away, the Mardi Gras incident. I kind of looked at it like, okay, I did that, so you can't trust me to stay gone. Okay, I get it. And at least I'm not dead.
So imagine this. You're 19 years old. Your story with this lifestyle and abuse began in your mid-teens, maybe 14, 15 years old. You've tried to flee. You feared for your life, but you miss your parents, and you want this all to be over. So you go back to Nebraska, and then you get sentenced for the bad check writing, but you have a hunch that you're being held in there as a way to keep you silent, to keep you at bay, because Franklin was now all over the news. Your abusers are starting to be investigated, and maybe you're safer in prison. And it wasn't a terrible prison in comparison to others, but you are there with women serving life for murder. But you're also there with girls like yourself, a petty white-collar crime, doing 3 to 4 years. But you're also the youngest inmate there amongst about 110 women. You're 19, locked up during the years when, especially as good of a student as Alicia was, your peers are going to college. But your life was stolen by a ring of adult, powerful men, and now you just have to wait it out. Your parents still don't know what had happened to you, but they are loving and they are there. They don't believe you should be let off the hook if you truly did write those bad checks, but you're their daughter and they love you.
I was the youngest person there, and at that time, you know, the Nebraska, called the Nebraska Center for Women, it's in York, Nebraska, and comparatively to other prisons all over the United States, it's a very small one. When I first went there, I remember there was only like maybe 110 women in the entire prison, so it's pretty small. You know, it still has, you know, it still has the big giant fence with the razor wire around it. There are people doing life there. There were people like me there that were just, you know, had a 3 to 4 year sentence, but there were also, like I said, murderers doing life and things like that. And, but it was still, it wasn't like going to Rikers Island or something. You know, my parents were very supportive. They understood, you know, I wrote those checks, and by this time they still didn't know anything. They just knew that I'd written some bad checks. And they were like, okay, you know, you did the crime, you do the time, and we love you, and we will, you know, stand by you and, you know, help you through this. But if you do the crime, you do the time. It's October. Now it's October. So I'm in prison. I make it through. The intake process, and it's pretty traumatic. It's nothing. Like, I mean, and I, like I said, I was the first person I knew that ever went to jail, you know, that I really knew.
So Alicia goes through a traumatic intake, and then through her initial 30-day period where she's essentially on watch, integrating her into prison life. And then, about a month in, October, she gets a visit from an angel of sorts. A man who risked his life to investigate this, and a man who believed Alicia and other victims.
It's in the evening, and it's October, and a guard, I'm in like the day room, a guard, I don't know if I'm in day room or I'm in cell, but a guard comes and says, hey, you have a visitor. And it's like 8, 9 o'clock at night. Who has a visitor? And like I said, there's only like 110 women in this prison. So if somebody gets a visitor at 9, 10 o'clock at night, that's something of note. People know, you know, like what is going on? Why are they taking her to the administration building? And that's when I met Gary Caradori. It was Gary Caradori and Karen Ormiston. And I go to this conference room, and he's there with Karen, and he tells me that he is the investigator for a Nebraska legislative committee called the Franklin Legislative Committee, where there's over $40 million missing, and there are... he's been investigating it, and they're basically, this legislative committee had decided that they were going to follow the money because, you know, $40 million missing, there's only supposed to be less than $2 million in this credit union, and now they're finding out that $40 million, where did this money come from, where did it go, and what is going on here? And so Gary tells me, you know, hey, I'm the investigator for it, and I'm investigating this money trail, and, you know, there's certain names that keep popping up that that there are some things that are just not kosher here. And, you know, the more I investigate Larry King, I see in some of the things that he does, and that, you know, he has this, you know, penthouse, and there's these cars, and there's this money, and there's these kids. And when I'm talking to people, your name is one of the names that come up. And I am floored, because earlier, I think at this point that one of the reasons why I am locked up is so that I will stay silent, and that I will be out of anyone's sphere of being able to find me to come talk to me. So I am like shocked that this guy shows up. And wow. if he is showing up, is he showing up to test me to see if I'll keep my mouth shut? You know, I don't care if it is like a Mayberry prison. Prison still is not a safe place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are scary people there. And so I am like in absolute shock that this guy is here and wants to talk to me. Because I thought I was kind of safe and away from anybody connecting me to anything. I thought, I'm just going to do my 4 years and I'm out of here, and let's just move on with life and hope that this thing is over. Gary starts to tell me a few things that I know he has talked to some people that know what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And it was mostly him talking to me and telling me things that he knew. And I asked him a few questions, but I got this sense from Gary that he was a decent guy. He was not a guy there that was going to test me or strong arm me or threaten me. But he was actually a decent guy. And I knew he didn't know what he was really asking me to do, which is kind of one of those things with this case, that when people like, yeah, I want to get involved, I want to do something, especially with Franklin, they just don't know. You can ask Nick. You just don't know what you don't know, and then when you do know, wow. And
mm-hmm.
So I knew at that point in time, and the other thing that I need to talk about is I had decided, it was before I turned 18, that because I had seen the people that just turned a blind eye, and that how terrible that was. And I had decided that when I turned 18, that I was then an adult, a grown-up, and that I had a responsibility to not turn a blind eye, because I knew. And if there was ever a time that I was in a position where I could stop this abuse that was going on, because I knew it was still going on, that I had a duty, not just to myself, but to any future victims, that if, because I'm not a snitch, but I'll tell you, if you hurt kids or you make kids do drugs, I will tell on you. And I had decided that, when I turn 18, if I have the opportunity to bust this ring, I have to do it. I have to be able to know that I did the right thing. And what's really kind of crazy is I turned 18 in September, and 18 or 19. And less than a month later, Gary Caradore is knocking at my door.
Mm-hmm.
So I told Gary, I don't know. I don't know if I want to talk to you, because I knew how I knew it was going to be a really rough road. And my family really is the most important thing to me. And I needed to be able to have their support to be able to do this. I told Gary, at this point in time, Gary did not know anything that I knew. I didn't tell him, yeah, I know stuff. Let me think about what I'm going to tell you. I just told him, let me think about it and I'll get back to you. And that weekend, my parents came up to visit me, and that's when I laid it all out for them. I told them everything. That is one habit I did pick up in prison, is I smoke. So I went outside to smoke a cigarette and invited them to come out with me. And I told them everything. And they were, it's hard to even describe. They were surprised, but they weren't surprised. All of a sudden, you know, we're talking the plane tickets on the coffee table made sense. You know, how I could move out and within a couple of days have a nice apartment, and how I had money. And, you know, Troy made sense. There's a lot of things that all of a sudden made sense. Yeah, and they understand that, you know, I wasn't some crazy check-writing, whack person. I mean, all of the things that I had done and that they had watched me do, and my running away, and some of the things that I did in high school, it all of a sudden made sense to them. Mm-hmm. And... they would ask me questions, and I mean, I don't know how you are or how other people are, but when you don't want to talk about something, you can actually say, hey, I'm not talking about it, and we're not talking about it, and that's that, and it's done, and you don't talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
They can ask 50 million times. It doesn't matter. You're not talking about it. Mm-hmm. And so I told them everything, and my folks, they don't just talk the talk, they walk the walk. They are moral people. They live moral lives, and they have integrity. And when I told them, okay, so there's this guy, and he's with the legislative committee, and he wants me to tell the committee about this stuff that went on, I'll do whatever you want to do, because, you know, this is what it's going to be. It could be bad. It could be really bad, Mom and Dad. And if we have to, you know, and we're a family, and what do you think I should do? And without hesitation, my parents were like, you know, we've always told you, you do the right thing. And standing up and giving testimony about what happened to you and what these people have done is the right thing to do. So we are in this together, and we support you in doing the right thing. Take the stand. Yeah, I don't think I could have survived this without them. As a matter of fact, I know that I couldn't survive this without them. But so we made the decision to that they would support me and stand with me, and that I should talk to Gary. So after that visit, I don't know if it was that same day or excuse me, the next day, I called Gary Caridori and said, okay, Gary, I know that you don't know what you're asking, but I'll talk to you. And Gary came back to prison, and we spent at least an hour to maybe three, me kind of giving him an overview.
Mm-hmm.
But I still wasn't really 100% sure. I figured that Gary was a decent guy, but I also didn't know what kind of investigator he was, or, you know, there have been decent people in this case that folded and were afraid. And believe me, I understand that. I get it. not everybody can stand up to it.
Mm-hmm.
Though I don't think... I understand fear. I don't understand, oh, I could lose my job. You know, I better turn the blind eye because I could lose my job. I mean, to me, that is just cowardice and unconscionable. But I wasn't exact 100% sure what, you know, Gary was made of, I guess, you know, because I didn't know him yet. And so I told him, because it also was kind of difficult because, you know, coming out to interview me in prison, he had to drive out to prison. It's not like, you know, York is in the middle of nowhere. And you know, you have to drive out. He'd have to get permission. It wasn't something that was necessarily easy for him to do. And I gave him Troy's name and Danny's name and told him, because I mean, those are the two people that, you know, had much of the same experiences that I did or were there. And mm-hmm. I gave him their names and I wanted to see if he could actually find them because, you know, they live under the radar. And this was before cell phones and, you know, that sort of thing and Facebook or MySpace or anything like that. And so I kind of did that as a test to see if he could, you know, do some real investigative work and actually find people that were in the shadows. And he did. The thing that people need to understand about prison is everything is controlled. You make a phone call. It has to be a collect phone call. You get a visitor. They have to sign in. Every, you know, your movements, everything is documented and controlled. It's not like you can run into somebody's office, pick up the phone, and secretly call somebody on the phone. It doesn't work that way. Everything is controlled. So, and this becomes important later when the prosecution and the media try and say it's a carefully crafted hoax. Well, I am completely in a controlled environment. It's not like I can call somebody and say, hey, let's make up a story together.
Mm-hmm.
Which is one of the reasons why that whole carefully crafted hoax smokescreen is just a bunch of baloney. I mean, there's no possible way.
How did they
that,
get away with it? No, I agree with you. I completely agree with you, and I know that. But like, how did? I don't know. Well, we'll talk about that later. Keep going with the timeline.
Yeah, and so he meets up with Troy and Danny, or he meets Troy, he finds Troy first, and then he and Troy go to Danny, and he starts talking with them, and he actually films, because I mean, I know that if you go on the internet, you can see the witness testimony tapes,
yeah,
that Gary Caradore took from back in 1988. And I believe that he taped Troy first and then Danny. And at some point after those, or maybe he did one, and then he came out to York and said, hey, I'd like to videotape your statement. And those videotapes are done, I mean, it's almost like, you know, you sit down at a table and you just start talking. I mean, every once in a while he would ask a question, you know, this or that, but it's mostly you just talking about memories that you have.
Mm-hmm.
And what becomes very interesting later, because at a certain point, Gary has, he has the videotapes of Troy, myself, and Danny initially. And I don't know if he had some other victims. He had a whole list of victims. You know, one of the things the news media at that time wanted to kind of portray that there was only like three or four of us. No, there's like 60.
Hmm. Wow.
You know, they wanted 60? To make it seem like there's, it was a large amount. It was a large amount.
Can I interrupt you real quick?
So, sure.
So I guess 60 doesn't necessarily surprise you now that my brain just remembered that there were so many others involved, like Boys Town too.
Mm-hmm.
How did you know? This is just a question I wanted to ask. How did you meet Troy, Paul? Even though I think you told me on a prior call you were not really friends with Paul. And what was your relation with Boys Town? Because I know a lot of victims came from there.
This goes back to, and I mean, and you can actually, you know, hear about it in those videotape testimonies. But I had went to, there was in Omaha, like a, I think it was Thursday nights, there was like a teen outdoor dance at a local like amusement park, fun park. Where they would have a dance and they had like a local DJ and it was like a teen hotspot kind of thing. And I had met some Boys Town kids from there and got invited to a party. Yeah. And you think it sounds fun and you think it sounds glamorous. And at first it is. And then you realize, and by the time you realize what's really going on, it's too late. And that seems to be, and that's one of the reasons why I'm talking about this now and why, I am, you know, I know that we're giving history on my background, but right now, today, I am an associate director of Epstein Justice and I am working on exposing these types of rings and educating people on how this happens, because it's one, it's still going on today, and two, there's, and I really, one of the reasons why I am, you know, telling you the details of my court and what happened after I came forward that I think is crucial is because victims are still being silenced. And there are still elements of our government and law enforcement that are suppressing victim stories and what happens to them.
Alicia had promised herself that she would fight for kids that were in her situation. She would not turn a blind eye. And frankly, she's mad that people do. And I don't blame her.